Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ground Zero by Amy Nicole Walker, narrated by Tristan James. Chapter 1. Heat, Humidity, and Homicide. The story of his life, Sawyer Key silently quipped. What would be the subtitle? A typical summer day in Savannah, Georgia? One dumpster fire to the next? Navigating hostile times while maintaining humanity. Sawyer recalled the pair of smoldering gray eyes that had tracked his every move when he arrived at the Midtown precinct. They were certainly hostile as hell. What the fuck? Sawyer asked out loud when he saw the large crowd gathered at his crime scene. Flipping on his sirens to disperse the throng of people, he pulled up to the barricade patrol had set up. A strong sense of foreboding settled in his gut as he made his way to one of the officers assigned to keep unauthorized personnel from stepping beyond the police tape. This level of attention was never a good sign.
Well, hello, sugar. I haven't seen you around here before. Are you new?
The unprofessional greeting caught Sawyer off guard, and he just barely suppressed the urge to cringe. He had approached the female officer at a crime scene, not a bar. A fresh start, Key. Don't make enemies day one. Let it slide. The detective's shield clipped to his belt was shiny, new, and felt as heavy as the dread in his stomach. He wasn't a stranger to law enforcement, but it was his first day on the job as a detective with the Savannah PD. That's Detective Sugar, he said, covering his irritation with humor. Most call me Sawyer or Detective Key, though. I'm with the Major Crimes Unit. The woman whose badge identified her as Officer Andrews extended her hand and he shook it. I'm meeting my partner here.
Oh,
the blonde woman said, raking her eyes over his dove-gray linen pants, lavender dress shirt, and amethyst-colored tie before meeting his eyes again.
I've heard of you.
I just bet she has.
I'm Keeley Andrews. It's nice to meet you. Detective Locke is already inside. Good luck.
She said, then snorted. It wasn't the first time Sawyer had been warned that morning about the potential lukewarm greeting he could expect to receive from his new, unwilling partner, Royce Locke. The same guy with the hostile gray eyes. Sawyer had listened to Chief Ellen Rigby speak about Locke for 45 minutes when he reported for duty, which was why Locke and Key were meeting at a crime scene instead of at the precinct as planned. Chief Rigby couldn't disguise her respect for Locke's performance on the job while, at the same time, she lamented about some of his methods.
He never breaks the law,
she'd been quick to tell Sawyer as she fixed herself a cup of coffee and offered him one of her bear claw pastries.
My wife makes these, knowing I can't resist them.
She patted her curvy hips.
It's starting to catch up to me. Everything starts going to hell for a woman once she hits middle age, while you men keep getting better.
Sawyer had thought it was an odd pivot from Locke and his borderline unlawful ways to her expanding hips, but he was starting to see there was a method to her madness. Ellen Rigby liked to keep people on their toes and to make sure they were paying attention. Sawyer also thought there was nothing hellish looking about the woman sitting across the desk studying him with hawkish blue eyes that probably didn't miss anything. Her medium brown curls were devoid of gray hair, either by genetics or from chemicals, and her makeup-free skin was nearly flawless, except for a few laugh lines around her mouth and eyes. Sawyer thought they added to her attractiveness instead of aging her. As for her hips, she had an hourglass figure that looked neither too big nor too small for her height.
I can't resist the pastries, just like I couldn't resist her all those years ago, even though I knew it could cost me my family and my career. I played hard, and I fought to win.
And here you are, Sawyer said.
And here I am. Now I play for keeps.
Sawyer accepted the pastry with a smile, then nearly choked on the powdered sugar that exploded into his mouth on the first bite.
Sherry is a bit heavy-handed with the powdered sugar, Chief Rigby had said with a wry smile. I don't think a dusting of sugar is in her vocabulary. She's from New Orleans, so it's in her blood. Sawyer made the connection right away, because he'd choked hard after taking his first bite of a beignet during his only visit to the city. He'd never eaten a bear claw before and thought the flaky, buttery pastry, almond paste, and slivered almonds were a lovely combination. Ellen Rigby's final words to him after their chat over coffee and a pastry still lingered in his head when he arrived at the crime scene in Riverside. "I wish you much luck, Detective. Locke's going to do everything in his power to push you away. Don't let him. He needs you."
"Nice meeting you too, Officer Andrews," Sawyer said before striding up the walkway leading to the porch. "Detective Sawyer Key with MCU." He flashed his badge to the officer assigned to the front door, tasked with making sure only approved personnel gained access to the house. Too many people in and out of a crime scene not only risked the admissibility of forensic evidence in court, but it wasted time when the lab spent hours testing evidence only to find out the DNA on sunflower seeds spat out at the scene belonged to one of the officers and not the killer.
"Officer Robert Jones, but everyone calls me Bobby. Booties and gloves on, Detective. Sign in here, please," he said in a monotone.
Accepting the clipboard, Sawyer filled out his name, badge number, and the time he arrived on the scene. He noted his partner had signed in a full 20 minutes earlier, which meant the call came in not long after Sawyer sat down in the chief's office. "Were you the responding officer?" Sawyer asked Officer Jones, noticing the black powder residue all along the white door casing left behind when a CSI tech dusted for fingerprints.
"No, sir. Officer Diego Fuentes was the first one on the scene. He's inside with Detective Locke, the ME, and the crime scene techs."
"Wow, it didn't take long to get everyone to the scene."
"This crime will make national news, and the media will start showing up within the hour, if not sooner."
Jones's voice trailed off, and Sawyer turned to see what had caught his attention. 4 news vans pulled in nearly simultaneously. 2 came in from the north, and 2 came from the south, meeting in the middle. Each van jockeyed for the closest spot to the Riverside residence, which Sawyer noted was nice, but didn't look like the kind of home belonging to someone important enough to warrant the frenzied feeling in the air, when the doors of the vans burst open and cameramen and reporters exploded into action. "Who lives here?" Sawyer asked Officer Jones, as he slid the booties over his Gucci leather loafers.
"Lived," Jones corrected. "Died from blunt force trauma to the head. They didn't tell you who the victim was."
The more they conversed, the more the officer relaxed around Sawyer.
"No,"
Sawyer said. The ominous feeling from when he arrived intensified as he snapped nitrile gloves in place. He'd hoped to settle into his new job with as little drama as possible, but it appeared he wouldn't be so lucky.
"Ever heard of Roland Putsinski?"
Sawyer's eyebrows lifted toward his hairline. "Who hasn't heard of the Putz?" Roland Putsinski was a disgraced shock jock of the vilest kind. He hated anyone who wasn't a white, straight Christian or male. He'd pushed the limits on his nationally syndicated radio show for decades before he went too far and was fired after his incendiary rhetoric incited a gay-bashing incident in Kissimmee, Florida.
"This is his house? I would have expected him to live someplace grander, too, but he probably couldn't afford it after losing the civil lawsuit filed by Micah Gassaway's family."
Sawyer remembered the story well. Micah had been the victim of the hate crime and had spent 2 months in a coma before passing away in the aftermath of the brutal beating.
$6 million is a lot of money to pay in punitive damages.
It wasn't enough. It could never be enough to pay for the harm the man had caused Micah's family.
He probably should have found a home in a gated community in one of the less pricey neighborhoods.
"Well, I'm sure he's living in a gated community now," Sawyer said dryly. Jones snorted, catching Sawyer's meaning. May he forever burn in the hell of his own making.
"Good to meet you, Officer Jones."
"Likewise, Detective."
He glanced over his shoulder, then returned his cool green eyes to meet Sawyer's.
Good luck to you, sir.
That's the third time someone has said those words to me in less than an hour.
You'll probably be hearing it every day for the rest of your career with the SPD.
Sawyer sighed, patted Jones's shoulder, then opened the door and stepped inside the home. The foyer, living room on the right, and dining room on the left were immaculately clean and empty of police personnel. Sawyer heard voices in the rear of the home, but took his time looking around the space. A cop could learn a lot about a victim by studying their surroundings and the types of things they held dear in their lives. Were there family photos on the walls, knick-knack collections on shelves or behind glass cabinet doors, or books or DVDs lying around, offering clues to the victim's relationships, hobbies, intellectual level, and choice of entertainment? Sawyer noted the furniture, although clean and tidy, looked to be old and well-used. Not what he'd expect from a man who had made millions on his previous show and from book sales. People actually paid nearly $30 a pop to read his hateful musings. Above the nondescript brown sofa hung a large painting showing a white man's fist gripping a lightning bolt next to an ornate cross. Below the image were the words, God's Chosen Race. On another wall was a poster of a naked buxom blonde sprawled in the center of a bed. The only thing shielding her vagina from the viewer's eyes was her hand. The words beneath the image read, Real men eat pussy. It was a miracle you lived this long. Facing the poster was a worn-out recliner, and beside it was a side table with an open bottle of lotion, a wad of used tissues, and a box of Kleenex. It didn't take a detective to know what the putz used the tissues and lotions for when kicking back in his recliner. A shiver of revulsion rippled through Sawyer, compelling him out of the room and down the hall toward the voices. The coppery smell of blood and the unforgettable aroma of death got stronger with each step deeper into the home. The hallway led to a smallish kitchen where a crime scene tech looked up from swabbing blood droplets on the floor. Based on the pattern and spacing of the droplets, Sawyer surmised they'd landed there after falling off the murder weapon.
Oh, hey, you're Detective Key, she said, appraising him from head to toe.
Unlike Officer Andrews, Sawyer only saw curiosity in the tech's eyes. He tried not to be a vain man, but he knew his 6'2", broad-shouldered frame, dark hair, and dark eyes appealed to men and women alike. I am, and you are?
CSI Griffin, but my friends call me Casey.
Can you tell me where I can find my partner, CSI Griffin? She smiled wryly. Did she expect Sawyer to consider her a friend within the first 5 seconds of meeting her? Griffin raised a hand and pointed over her shoulder.
The hallway leads back to his home office / recording studio.
Recording studio? Sawyer asked. I thought he lost his radio show.
He did, but you can't keep a vile man down. Putz started a podcast bitching about the evils of political correctness and how the women's movement has set our country back. There was nothing scarier to him than a woman who demanded equal pay and refused to be sexually harassed in the workplace. Putz didn't like our kind either.
Our kind? Sawyer asked with a raised brow. Then he noticed the rainbow lanyard holding her ID badge.
Oh, shit. That was totally inappropriate of me to say. I read about your battle with the sheriff's department. I hope you'll enjoy working for SPD a lot more.
Thanks. I guess I shouldn't be surprised Putz found a new way to spew his venom, he said, steering them back to a more comfortable topic.
Someone put a stop to his vitriol once and for all, Griffin said, returning her focus to her task. Good luck, Key.
Annoyance sparked inside him, but he shoved it aside and headed down the hallway to get the awkward initial introduction out of the way. Maybe Locke would go easy on him with witnesses around. The office was much bigger than Sawyer had anticipated. The area consisted of a large office space with a soundproof booth at one end. He stood in the doorway, taking in the quiet effectiveness of the technicians photographing the room, sketching the scene and looking for evidence, while the M.E. and Sawyer's new partner squatted on either side of the prone body. Sawyer couldn't help but notice the way the dark denim clung to Locke's firm ass, but forced his eyes upward to avoid additional awkwardness should he get caught ogling him. A tall hunk of a man, he presumed to be Officer Fuentes, stood behind the M.E. looking over her shoulder.
"Someone really hated this man," the officer said. "I've never seen such a brutal attack before."
"There's a lot of passion in this slaying," the M.E. said. "His skull is so battered, I don't think I'll be able to pinpoint the murder weapon unless the killer was kind enough to leave it behind." The officer lifted his head to look around the room and noticed Sawyer standing in the doorway.
"Oh, hey," he said. "You must be Detective Key."
His southern drawl sounded more Texan than Georgian.
"I am," Sawyer said, noticing the way Locke's body tensed.
Sawyer turned his attention to the officer, who approached with an outstretched hand.
"Diego Fuentes, it's good to meet you. I've heard a lot about you."
"Yeah?" Sawyer asked, lifting an inquisitive brow. Diego's handshake was firm and friendly, as was the expression on his face. If Sawyer wasn't mistaken, the smile pulling on Fuentes' lips was extra friendly, flirty even. He would have been tempted to find out what kind of things Fuentes had heard about him, but he was distracted by Locke, rising to his full height. He was blonde, 6 feet of muscle, broad shoulders that tested the metal of the black cotton t-shirt he wore, and enough fury vibrating off him to choke a horse. Sawyer swallowed hard with the realization his job was going to be much more difficult than he'd realized. Suddenly, all the good luck wishes he'd taken as jokes made sense.
"All good things," Fuentes said.
Locke turned, and their eyes met for the first time. Sawyer nearly sucked in a breath from the intensity in his partner's gray eyes. Every warning he'd received, wild, rebellious, obstinate, showed in Locke's stormy gaze. Of all the things he'd been warned about, no one had alluded to the emotion that struck Sawyer like a fist to his gut. Wounded. Wounded animals were known to strike out and bite anyone who came near, even the ones who only wanted to help them. Sawyer had seen the same look on the gray kitten he'd found hiding behind his trash can on the worst night of his life. All he wanted to do was pick up the hissing ball of fur and cuddle him against his chest. But sharp teeth and claws met his every attempt. It took weeks of calmly sitting on the stoop while the kitten ate the food Sawyer provided before he trusted him enough to allow a single scratch behind one ear. Another week before Sawyer could run a hand over his bony spine, and another 2 before Sawyer could pick him up and feel him purr against his chest. Sawyer instinctively knew Royce Locke was the most wounded thing, man or beast, he'd encountered in his life. If he ventured too close, Locke's teeth and claws would cut deeper than anything he'd ever experienced, scarring him, and his venom would poison his soul. Sawyer's brain told him to turn around and walk away before it was too late, but the man who ached to heal wounded things couldn't turn away from the challenge glaring at him.
"It's about fucking time," Locke said tersely, striking the first blow.
Chapter 2. Stifling his irritation, Sawyer calmly said, "Sorry, my meeting with Chief Rigby went longer than I expected." Which was especially odd considering she was the one who sought out Sawyer for the position, not the other way around.
"So, Roland Putzinski, huh?"
"Most of him, anyway," Locke replied, the scowl still marring his handsome face.
Then he turned his back on Sawyer and returned to studying the body, leaving him to follow or fuck off. Sawyer chose the former. Instead of crouching again, Locke remained standing, his body coiled tight with tension, reminding Sawyer of a jungle cat on the verge of pouncing. Ignoring Locke's brusque non-welcome, Sawyer moved to stand beside him.
"Good morning, Dr. Fox," Sawyer said to the medical examiner as he approached. Good morning, Detective Key. I'd shake your hand, but I'm...
She lifted her bloody, nitrile-gloved hands.
It's always nice to see you.
Likewise. Sawyer felt Locke's scrutiny as he looked between Dr. Fox and him. He figured Chief Rigby would have at least given Locke the rundown on his background when she informed him he was getting a new partner. Maybe Locke wouldn't be so pissed if he knew Sawyer had 7 years of experience as a detective with the Chatham County Sheriff's Department. Dr. Fox served as the medical examiner for the entire county, not just the Savannah Police Department, and she'd worked with Sawyer on many homicides during his tenure with CCSD. Sawyer ignored Locke and focused on the victim before looking at the gore inside the sound booth. Blood and brain matter sprayed the soundproofing material on the walls and ceiling in the booth. Sawyer noted several teeth and bone fragments in the pooled blood on the floor. Christ, are you even able to make a positive ID of the body?
The disgusting tattoo on his right forearm matches the one seen in all of his publicity photos,
Dr. Fox said, not bothering to hide her revulsion. Sure enough, the tattoo on the victim's right arm matched the God's chosen race symbols in the painting above the couch. I wonder if we'll find his other repulsive message tattooed somewhere on his body, Sawyer asked. Dr. Fox snorted.
I'll be sure to let you know later.
How do we know this isn't one of his zealous fans with a matching tattoo?
Excellent point, Dr. Fox said,
while Locke silently absorbed the conversation.
Facial recognition is out of the question with open and depressed skull fractures such as these. I can try to match dental records to his remaining teeth, but I'm not hopeful. DNA is our surest bet, but we'll need something to compare it to. The techs will grab his toothbrush and hairbrush, and I'll try to extract a viable sample.
He's been arrested before, so we can match his fingerprints, Locke said, finally breaking his silence.
Good to know, Fox remarked.
Sawyer turned to his partner, no longer willing to be ignored.
Who called in the homicide?
The better question is who didn't call it in, Locke replied dryly,
his eyes still focused on Dr. Fox's activities. He finally turned those turbulent gray eyes to Sawyer, sneer still firmly in place.
The putz's gruesome death was recorded during his latest podcast, which went live this morning. As soon as his equally vile fans heard his murder, calls started flooding in.
Any sign of forced entry? He inquired.
No.
Locke's tone was devoid of any inflection, but Sawyer would take the robotic replies over being ignored any day of the week. Dr. Fox removed a thermometer from the small incision she'd cut in Putz's abdomen to measure his liver temperature.
Based on the liver temperature and stages of rigor and liver mortis, I'm going to estimate his time of death to be 12 hours ago.
Sawyer looked at his watch and saw it was 9:45. Around 21:45, then.
That's my best guess.
Locke finally turned toward Sawyer, folded his arms across his impressive chest, and addressed him directly. The scowl was still firmly in place, but his tone was less pissed off and more resigned to his fate.
The sound booth was constructed to block outside noises from disturbing his recording, which meant he didn't hear his assailant enter his house or his office.
This home is immaculately kept. The front rooms aren't disturbed in any way. Neither are his kitchen or even his office, Sawyer said, gesturing to the tidy desk where the only thing out of place was the black residue left behind after CSI techs dusted for prints. As angry as the assailant was, there are no signs they disturbed or removed anything from the victim's home.
The motive definitely wasn't robbery.
An African-American tech wearing stylish black-rimmed glasses approached with a wallet in his gloved hands. He extended the black leather trifold wallet with the Putz's symbols embroidered on the front.
I can't say all the man's credit cards are in the wallet, but there are no empty slots.
Sawyer opened the wallet and noticed all the slots were filled, including the one with a plastic window showing Roland Putzinski's license with his arrogant, smirking face. He turned the wallet upright and whistled when he saw how much money was inside it. Thumbing through the 20s and 50s, he said, "There has to be at least $500 in here. I've never seen a robbery where the assailant only took part of the money and none of the credit cards. But I guess it's possible."
"Usually it's the reverse," Locke said when he moved closer to peer inside the wallet. "A lot of times assailants stage robberies to make it look like a home invasion gone wrong. Not this guy."
"Or gal," Sawyer added, trying to ignore how good Locke smelled, the dark blonde stubble dusting his partner's jaw and accentuating his lush, full lips, meant the sandalwood, amber, and vanilla scent didn't come from the man's aftershave. Cologne? Body wash. Not that it mattered, or should matter, anyway. It doesn't take brute strength to bash someone's skull in with a blunt object.
"True. It's hard to tell which minority group of people hated the putts more,"
Locke agreed. "It looks like our perp got in and out without taking anything and without detection," Sawyer surmised.
"CSI is going over the backyard with a fine-tooth comb, and uniformed officers are canvassing the neighborhood."
"Detectives," an animated voice said from behind them. Locke and Sawyer turned at once to look at the officer in the doorway.
"CSI found the murder weapon in the trash cans out back."
Sawyer and Locke started for the door at the same time. Sawyer stopped and gestured for Locke to precede him and fell in step behind him. Sawyer's eyes were drawn to his partner's firm ass once more, but he didn't dare permit them to linger. His gaze traveled the length of Locke's legs and noticed he had excellent taste in footwear. Sawyer had the same pair of black leather Bruno Magli boots in his closet. He also couldn't keep himself from appreciating the way Locke's shoulder holster accentuated the muscles in his back and shoulders.
"Finding anything exciting, Casey?"
Locke asked the CSI tech when they walked into the kitchen. He was obviously one of Casey's friends. CSI Griffin had moved on from swabbing blood droplets to dusting empty beer bottles for prints. It wasn't likely the killer stopped to drink a beer, but stranger things had happened. It was better to leave no stone unturned than end up overlooking a key piece of evidence.
"No, sir," Griffin said. "All the excitement is in the backyard, and I hear some guffawing coming from the other side of the house. Tex must have found something juicy that doesn't pertain to the crime. Boys," she said, then rolled her eyes.
Sawyer couldn't imagine a situation that would justify crime techs laughing at the scene of a gruesome homicide. If a videographer were on the scene, their laughter could taint the jury's opinion of the investigation if the footage had to be played in court. Sawyer glanced over at Locke, who wore a similar perplexed expression on his face. "I'll check it out," Sawyer told Locke. "You head out and take a look at the murder weapon." Locke's expression changed from confused to irritated in a blink of an eye. He was either still pissed about Sawyer's presence, irritated he had the gall to take the lead, or both. Sawyer didn't care, nor did he back down from the glare Locke gave him. After a few seconds of awkward silence, Locke turned and walked away without saying a word. "Breathe in, hold, release."
"Hmm," Griffin said. "That went better than I predicted."
Sawyer didn't comment. He headed down the short hallway until he reached the master bedroom. The CSI techs had gathered around something that had caught their interest in the nightstand drawer beside the victim's bed.
"So, the big poster with Locke's sister spread-eagled on the bed was just a front,"
the tech on the right said.
"Wait, is that really Locke's sister in the poster?"
asked the tech on the left.
"Hell, if I know, but I thought it would be fun to razz him about it," Righty said.
Lefty snorted.
"Ask him to get it autographed for you."
"I wouldn't if I were you," Sawyer said firmly. Both men spun around to face the newcomer, their eyes wide and mouths gaping open. "You are aware of how inappropriate your discussion is, right? Not only was the topic vulgar and offensive,
but it could have been picked up by a videographer if one had been present. Can you imagine how the jury would respond to hearing your juvenile conversation in the background?
I...
Wrighty stammered. His face was beet red from embarrassment.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?